This is Read On Air with Red Zell, for those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books and reading that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Sale. This week, Irvin Welsh's much-loved characters return to screens across the country in Trainspotting 2. But often, screen adaptations have a grumbled, "It's not as good as the book," from the fans of the original. We decided to hear what the authors have to say. Kate Summerskill recalls when Mr. Witcher made the leap.
It was great fun when they then started inventing fictional stories for Witcher to investigate.
I revisit the audiobook of Brokeback Mountain, and Robert talks to Irvin himself.
I think they just, you know, in terms of sort of kind of translating it to different medium, I think just people have to be a wee bit creative about it, you know.
That's all coming up in today's show. As anyone who knows me can tell you, I'm a great fan of detective stories. So when I heard that Kate Summerskill had set out to reinvestigate the country house murder mystery that inspired the genre, 1860s Murder at Roadhill House, I didn't wait for it to come to the RNIB library. I went straight out and bought the CD box set. And The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher was even better than I'd hoped. Not only did it reveal facts about the case that I'd never known, but it read like a novel. A really good novel. No wonder it became a bestseller and was adapted for TV. Since then, Kate has brought her investigative rigour and her literary flair to another two cases. Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, which was another bestseller, and last year, The Wicked Boy, the mystery of a Victorian child murderer, which re-examines the case of a 13-year-old boy who murdered his mother, then took his younger brother to watch W.G. Grace open the batting at Lord's. Kate, thank you for joining us and welcome to Read On Air. A couple of years ago, you said something that I think sums up your writing. I'm a journalist, playing historian, and then I try and convert what I've found into something like a novel. And I believe that you were working as a journalist when you came across the material for your first book, The Queen of Whale Key.
Yes, that's right. I was writer and editor on the obituaries desk of the Daily Telegraph. This wild story about a female motorboat racer from the 1920s who dressed as a man, who was obsessed with a small leather doll, and who bought an island in the Bahamas and ruled it like a despot, came my way. And I embarked on trying to find out more, and it became my first book.
What makes your work so powerful is that it's character-driven. Mr. Witcher is quite a character. Was it he who attracted you to the story of the Roadhill House murder in the first place?
It was the case itself and the strangeness and horror of it that compelled me.
Mr. and Mrs. Kent were scouring the house for their son. "I was here, there and everywhere," said Mrs. Kent, "looking for him. We were all in a state of bewilderment, going backwards and forwards from room to room." Samuel extended the search to the grounds. "At about 7:30, said Holcomb, "he told the gardeners that young Master Saville was lost, stolen and carried away. That was all he said, and he ran round the garden. We went out directly in search of the child."
"I desired the gardeners to search the premises to see if they could find any trace of the child," explained Samuel. "I mean to say, traces of the child or anyone having left the premises."
Gough helped search the gardens and the shrubbery. Samuel asked the gardeners if there were any policemen nearby.
It was a three-year-old boy in a middle-class family, prosperous family in the countryside, who was taken from his bed and murdered, his throat cut.
Foley watched over Saville's corpse again the next day. All the Mrs. Kent came to kiss the boy's body, as did Elizabeth Gough. Afterwards, the nursemaid told Mrs. Kent that she had kissed the poor little child.
And it was clear that the culprit was somebody in his house, one of the servants or a member of his family.
"A crime has just been committed, which for mystery, complication of probabilities and hideous wickedness is without parallel in our criminal records. The security of families and the sacredness of English households demand that this matter should never be allowed to rest till the last shadow in its dark mystery shall have been chased away by the light of unquestionable truth. The horror of this case was that the corruption lay inside the domestic sanctum,
that the bolts, locks and fastenings of the house were hopelessly redundant. The secret lies with someone who was within. The household collectively must be responsible for this mysterious and dreadful event. Not one of them ought to be at large till the whole mystery is cleared up. One or more of the family is guilty. The Morning Post article was reprinted in the Times the next day and in newspapers throughout the country over the rest of the week. "Let the best detective talent in the country be engaged," demanded the Somerset and Wilts Journal. On Thursday, a Wiltshire magistrate renewed his plea to the Home Secretary to send a detective to Rhode, and this time the request was granted. On Saturday, the 14th of July, Sir George Cornwall Lewis, Lord Palmerston's Home Secretary, instructed Sir Richard Mayne, the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, to dispatch an intelligent officer to Wiltshire as soon as possible. "Inspector Witcher to go," Mayne scribbled on the back of the Home Office directive. The same day, Detective Inspector Jonathan Witcher received his orders to head for Rhode.
It was the figure of Jack Witcher, the detective, who gave me my in and gave me a way of approaching the case that made it fresh, and also, I realised, showed me that this case had been a kind of template for detective fiction, and Witcher himself a figure for the detective hero that we still watch on television dramas today and read about in books.
None of the accounts that I'd read before actually really focused on Mr. Witcher as a human being. He was a policeman who barged his way into this rather standard Victorian family.
Partly this is a story about class, because the police, including the detectives, of which he was one of the first, were working class men. He was taking the roof off the apparently respectable, prosperous and educated family and finding all kinds of dark secrets, jealousies, betrayals going on within. And so part of the great attraction and disgust that the case aroused at the time and still is to do with the fact that he was exposing something really taboo in order to investigate the case. And he went in and fearlessly made his investigations and then made his accusation. And this was the really compelling thing about his story. Was he went to the Rhode Hill House murder case in 1860 with a reputation as the Prince of Detectives. And he did a brilliantly astute job solving the murder, but he wasn't able to find the evidence to prove his case, and so it ruined him. Very soon afterwards, the person he had accused confessed, so he was vindicated. And I was very happy to discover that he went on to have a marvellous second career as a private investigator.
And I know that some of the listeners will know Mr. Witcher from the ITV series. How did you feel about the adaptation of your book?
I thought it was very good. I had recently finished the book and I felt, well, I've told the story my way. I have no expertise in television. So I was happy for someone who did know what they were doing in that field to tell the story their way. And I was very curious as to what would happen. And of course, it was very different from the book because you have to do things differently for drama. It focused very much on two characters, and it was a kind of, you know, psychological drama between them without all the sort of digression and context that I enjoyed being able to put into the book. But I thought it was very good, and it was great fun when they then started inventing fictional stories for Witcher to investigate. My project, which was to sort of trace back from the fictional detectives of now to their origin, in fact, in Jack Witcher's life and work. And now here he was inspiring a fictional drama series on television very directly and under his own name, as it were. It was very interesting for me in that way as well.
That's wonderful. You've brought him back to life twice.
I've never written about anyone who is famous or well-known already. much more sort of animated by people who have fallen through the cracks. I suppose they can feel a little bit more like my own creations. I feel a greater intimacy with them. To find people who no one's heard of and to have the challenge and adventure, almost like a detective's research in itself, of trying to find enough to make them vivid. It's not just about finding facts, it's about finding often dramatic things. I tend to choose rather lurid, sensational stories. And so it's a form of sort of escapism into another life. And the more obscure the life, the more exciting the task of reconstruction is.
Which I think brings us rather neatly on to Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, who, despite the fact that she was on trial, actually, I ended up feeling that it was the Victorian establishment that you put on trial whilst writing about her.
Yes, she was a well-to-do Victorian married woman who was extremely unhappily married and whose husband read her diary and discovered, apparently, that she'd had an affair with a family friend. And he went crazy and he sued for divorce in one of the first cases after the passing of the Divorce Act. And she resisted the divorce and thus protected the family friend by claiming that she was an erotomaniac and that the diary was not fact but fiction and that it had been a record of her fantasies and delusions. She was damning herself as a liar in order to protect the family of the man who she had an affair with. And the husband was, of course, absolutely furious at this ruse. So it's a very sort of morally sort of intricate story about, you know, the rights and wrongs and the way in which the court handled and decided upon how to measure something so sort of unknowable as whether a woman's private writings should be given the weight of evidence in court or should be accepted as the a ravings of a maniac.
Well, it's a wonderful read. The fantastic fact that Dickens turns up in the book and various other literary figures are actually passing through history as we are reading about the case.
There is a kind of a tangle, a confusion of fact and fiction. In the Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, most sort of crucially, is the diary fact or fiction? How can we tell? How does it matter? And the shapes in which I choose to tell the stories are very much derived from fiction. It's novels that influence me more than anything, and the stories I choose have a novelistic feel to them. But I have set myself the task of using only facts in the course of telling the story. So I think that the things that I'm interested in writing very much draw on both a history and a literary disciplines, and trying to tie the two together and seeing how they work upon each other is what really interests me.
And how did you come across The Wicked Boy?
I was browsing newspapers from the 1890s. I fancied it was a decade that I would like to write about. And I came across this story about the two boys, aged 12 and 13, who'd been found in a house in East London. And the neighbours had forced their way in because of the smell coming from the house in the summer of 1895 and had discovered the boy's mother's body lying in a room upstairs. And the older boy, the 13-year-old, immediately confessed and said that he'd murdered her, he'd done it with a knife, and that they had been in the house with her corpse for the previous 10 days, and they had been to Lord's to watch the cricket, they'd been fishing in Southend, they'd been to the theatre, basically living it up. Of course, the Victorian press had reacted with absolute sort of horror to this very callous and very sort of intimate crime. The boys were tried, they were charged with murder, and I was just absolutely fascinated by why. The older boy did it, but the two boys plotted their mother's murder together. And somehow the questions that were asked in the court and by the police were similar to, but not exactly the same as the questions that I wanted answered. And so I wanted to gather everything I could and sort of try to read between the lines and try to work out what had really happened here and what became of them. If we look at really terrible juvenile crimes now, of necessity, the perpetrators kind of vanish eventually. They're you know, given new identities or remain incarcerated or whatever. But this is long enough ago, I thought there might be a chance that I would find out what happened to these two boys. I really wanted to sort of solve that mystery, and I hoped that that would help me solve the mystery of why they'd killed their mother.
The Victorians wanted to find out, too, what made a murderer, and believed that the shape of the head could influence whether a man was going to be a murderer or not.
There was there were some sort of theories that were circulating in the popular press from continental Europe about the way that a man's ears or a woman's ears stuck out, or their eyes bulged, or their chin receded, were clues to the fact that they would be either lunatic or criminal. And so when these boys, Robert and Natty Coombs, appeared in court, there was a quality to the reporters writing about them, which was they were sort of being tested, their features were being sort of tested against these templates of criminal and lunatic physiognomy. There were pictures drawn of them, sometimes reflecting those theories. Of course, the place those theories take you, as some of the commentators in the press observed, was that if you were born with these terrible sort of degenerate flaws which would lead you to criminality or lunacy, it might be best that you be aborted at birth, as they put it. So there was a great outcry among some of the press to have both Natty and Robert hanged, whatever the cause of their crime, because it was better that they didn't breed and that they didn't exist.
Gosh, and the lurid fascination in the details, the minutiae, shows that, well, maybe things just haven't changed.
So in some ways, the coverage is quite shocking for its explicitness. The detail that's given about the decomposition of a corpse, about wounds and injuries, is to modern sensibilities quite shocking. The fascination, the sort of prurient desire to really know as much as you can, to almost get inside the house and see what happened, is very, very present in the press. And I'm aware it's also part of my project. You know, when I write these books, I'm aware that these impulses are quite complicated, and some of it is a kind of prurient curiosity, as well as an urge to understand. And to sort of unravel the reasons for sort of abnormal psychology and tragic events and so on.
Do you put a brake on yourself? Because you never sensationalise.
I think I tend to choose stories that are already so over-dramatised in their nature. They're so melodramatic and vivid and intense that it is necessary to write with some restraint, and it is unnecessary to add anything to it. In fact, it does the material a disservice to try to hype it up. Although the way in which I organise the material is a kind of interpretation and a comment. So in no way would I say that my views are not present. They are, but they're not present really in sort of adjectives and, you know, and overt interpretation. It's just sort of kind of how you do it. When I get very interested in the psychology and the fate of the boys, the murderers, the murderer and his brother, his accomplice, to forget about the victim, that's a way in which I have to correct myself and think again, you know, to make sure that in the interests of telling, that I don't get so caught up in trying to make some of the characters emotionally sympathetic that you sort of demonise other characters. So there are lots of sort of moral decisions of that kind to be taken along the way.
Well, Kate Summerscale, thank you very much for giving up so much of your time to speak to us on Read On Air.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
In the meantime, if you haven't read The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, it is available from the RNIB Library, TB number 16062. And Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace is TB number 20035. The Wicked Boy is available commercially, but hopefully coming to the library shelves soon. Do you have a best loved book that has survived the journey from the page to the big or small screen, or maybe one that didn't. I'd love to hear from you. The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk.
The Moth.
I'm Jay Ellison. Join us for more true personal stories told live on stage. No scripts, no notes, no nothing. Each Moth Radio Hour is a mix of funny and heartbreaking tales that captivate and surprise and delight audiences around the world with their honesty and bravery and humor. That's the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Wednesdays from 8 p.m. and Sundays at 11 a.m. on RNIB Connect Radio. This is Read On Air.
Welcome back. Here on the show, we love to talk to people who are passionate about the written word. And I recently had the pleasure of talking to book blogger Kevin Beesting.
Thank you very much, Red. It's a pleasure to be on with you. I've always been an avid reader, and it was a sad time when I had to stop reading books. RNIB Overdrive came along. It was so easy to access audiobooks just by downloading them, so you can read as quickly or as slowly as you want. I've got such a long wish list now for the books that I want to read in the future. I'll just never get through even my own wish list, never mind the amount of books that are available. And there are new ones coming online all the time as well, which is encouraging. But I do enjoy doing the book reviews that are on there. The one that I'm halfway through at the moment is Cold Blood by Andy McNab, which is part of the Nick Stone series. The Flame Bearer was a good one as well. I mean, I do also like to read comedian books and even autobiographies. Alan Bennett, Dawn French, Absolute Pandemonium by Brian Blessed was one that I read last year. But this year, I think the one that's edging it at the moment is David Jason, My Life. At the moment, that one is the contender for January 17th. And the 2016 winner was up against many, many top authors, The Visitors, written by Rebecca Maskell. I think I've chosen it because of the depth of feeling and the emotion that runs throughout the book. A girl that is born, she becomes both deaf and blind, which obviously means she cannot talk, she cannot communicate. And then one day somebody comes along and starts talking with touch language. The young girl grows up and develops, and it just shows how people can come through total adversity.
I enter the world in a flood of fluid and blood, pulled by the hands of doctor. When I cry out and open my eyes, I see a grey blur. Within it, crowds a host of faces, pale and curious. They whisper and nod. This is my first meeting with the visitors. Mother has suffered five who died inside her before me. I am the miracle who survived. But my eyes are wrong. I can see something placed before me, but little beyond that. I learn to listen and touch so well that I can discern father from nanny, from doctor, from mother, from stranger, by the click of the door and the pressure of heel on rug. The visitors make no sound in movement, but I hear their voices. I am a good little talker, saying new words as a fish lays eggs. When I am nearly two, the fever comes, a heat like boiling soup. My ears are inflamed and leak pus. Father's voice. Always father, always close. Nanny's voice too, and doctors, all grow faint, and I think they whisper to spare me discomfort. But fade away they do, to nothingness and nowhere, and never return. My ears are spoiled. Even the visitors hush and lose their voices, looking in on me from time to time, shaking their solemn heads in pity.
And his winning title, The Visitors, by Rebecca Maskell, is in the RNIB Library, TB22295. And you can find all of his audiobook recommendations by visiting his blog, Blind Kevin Dog Spence, which is all one word. Those opening bars of Iggy Pop's Lust for Life will now forever bring to my mind Renton, Begbie and Spud, as they exist in Danny Boyle's masterful screen adaptation of Irvin Welsh's short stories. Robert Kirkwood caught up with Tandine Byrne, the narrator of the commercial audiobooks, and Irvin Welsh to talk about the books, the films and the challenges of transitions from page to talking book.
Hello, Mark. So what you been up to for 20 years?
In cinemas now is T2, Trainspotting.
Choose life. Choose Facebook, Twitter, Instagram and hope that someone, somewhere cares.
Missed you, mate.
I missed you too, Spud.
T2 is loosely based on the Irvin Welsh books Porno and Trainspotting, both of which, and the prequel Skag Boys, are available from the RNIB library, along with the books Filth and Glue.
Hello, Franco.
Simon. I'm home.
But if you've seen T2, you may be wondering what happens next. As I said, the films are only loosely based on the works of Irvin Welsh, but in one of his latest books, The Blade Artist, we discover the unusual direction Francis Begbie's life has taken. It was recorded by Tandine Byrne in the RNIB Talking Book Studios in Glasgow.
As he elevates her skywards, the bright sun seems to burst out from behind Eve's head, offering Jim Francis a transcendental moment that he pauses to savour before he lowers the child. The hot sand will soon punish his bare feet, he thinks, turning away from the solar flare, and he'll have to watch she doesn't burn. Eve is fine for now, though. Her bubbling machine gun giggles, urging him to continue the game.
A clip of The Blade Artist, played with the permission of Penguin Random House and Irvin Welsh. The voice behind it, Tandine Byrne, joined me to tell me about The Blade Artist.
Well, Begbie is back. In essence, Francis Begbie returns to Edinburgh because his son's been murdered and he gets into all sorts of exploits.
Franco sets about trying to piece together Sean's last days. His first port of call is the flat in Gorgie where his son met his demise. It is tucked down a sunless, tenemented side street at the back of Tynecastle Stadium. Canals of moss grow between its cobblestones and a deathly stillness and silence pervades.
Now, last we heard from him, he was being hit by a car at the end of Porno. Where is he now?
It's funny, that comes up quite a bit. He's got a bad leg, definitely. He's been 8 years in jail, but he's become rehabilitated and become a very successful artist and has moved to California. He's been in California for 6 years, I think. He's very settled, married there, two kids, and has completely changed his life around.
Is it still the same Begbie, though?
Yeah, well, it's the way that it is with people. That's what he explores. It's like, can people change? Can people change completely? He certainly feels he doesn't feel connected to that Begbie again, but obviously once he gets back to Edinburgh, it starts to have its effect.
Now, you've done almost all of Irvin Welsh's books. Have you got any favourites?
Oh, I think virtually all of them. They're all really so special in their own way. This is quite different, again, from any of the others. I really see the qualities in them all. I couldn't say. I mean, obviously, Filth is very close to me because I did it as a one-man show, which I've just recently
managed to get. I've put it up on my Vimeo actually as well. People could have a look. I did the show in Canada, Calgary, and I got it filmed back in 2003, and I never actually ever saw the film get made. But I just got it transferred, and I put it up on my Vimeo page, and the whole of the show is there, and that means a lot to me. But it's just each one that comes along seems to have its own qualities, really.
Now, when you mention filth there, a lot of Irvine Welsh's work doesn't really lend itself to audio, particularly in filth, where the words of the tapeworm overlay the words of the narrator. How did you work around that?
Well, what we did then is we recorded, because you can see the other words underneath, we did a sort of double track type of thing where you had my voice coming through as and now. Yeah, they managed it on that one. There's some others like Marabou Stark Nightmares. I didn't do that one, but I can see the trickiness that would have been in that. I think he doesn't get enough recognition for the quality serving, the way that he plays around with words on the page so much of the time, which is obviously tricky to be able to get across for audiobook. And I don't know what it would be like on Braille. I don't know how they would manage that. Yeah.
At Glasgow's I Write Book Festival, I asked Irvine Welsh about that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really. It's funny because you don't really think about that as a writer. You know, you're trying to tell the story, and then you realise there's all these different mediums. You know, there's kind of you think about. You know, you don't really think about the audiobook. You don't really think about the possibility that might be made into a film. You don't really think about the stage play or anything like that. You think about it very much in the medium that you're writing in the book, you know. So, but I think they just, you know, in terms of sort of kind of translating it to different medium, I think just people have to be a little bit creative about it, you know.
You are sort of stymied when you're doing an audio version because your creativity is limited by the fact that you've got to produce an audio version of the text itself.
My friend Tamdeen Byrne does the audiobooks, most of the audiobooks for me, and he's an actor and he's very good, and he did filth on stage and he did the tapeworm on stage, so it helps having somebody like him involved.
The RNIB version of Filth is narrated by Jonathan Hackett, and to give you an idea, here's a couple of passages.
Then I'll get myself charged up for our little specialist club's activities. I have to keep it going. Keep going for the tedious ritual of putting Alfior's son through it.
Eat! I eat through my skin, and I hold on with my jaws. Slowly, so slowly, I'm consuming the matter that surrounds me, ingesting and excreting through my body, through my skin. I have to eat to move on, to consume, to live, to consume.
What is it that he's trying to say, Saint? Help, police, hospital. Or was it help, please, hospital? It doesn't really matter, that little point of detail, because his life is ebbing away.
Human existence distilled to begging for the emergency services. You pushed me away, mister.
You rejected me. You tricked me and spoiled things between me and my true love.
Jonathan Hackett reading from the RNIB version of Filth.
Now, I produced the RNIB talking book version of Glue, and I think I used about six actors on it, and you did that on your own.
I did.
How was it going from, like, Juice Terry to an American girl and all of the other characters that are in there?
I didn't remember it being particularly so. That I mean, these were abridged in a way. That's what was trickier in the past, is that most of them were always abridged. I did more, the very first one back with Trainspotting, where the pair of us did it, it was abridged on cassette, it was way back then. But we did an unabridged version of Trainspotting just a couple of years ago. And we also did Skagboys fully, and Decent Ride has been fully, and this will be, and that's what's great now. I'd love to be able to go back and do them all again, do the whole shebang. But yeah, you just have to write it a lot of the time, and then get the sort of, rather than just sort of thinking, you can't completely transform your voice really in it. Well, I can't really. So I just try and find the essence of the character in myself, because often you can relate to the characters. That's what's great with it.
So it's a narration rather than a performance.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you are narrating, but it's sort of, you're also trying to make it in the moment as well. There's interesting sections in this one where it's Bigby recounting these circumstances in his, when he was a young teenager, and it's all written in italics, and it definitely needs to have a different feel, but it doesn't really tell you what that would be. So I sort of tried it as if he was maybe in a psychiatrist's chair, almost like that as well, but he's reliving his youth, so it does have a sort of teenage quality to it. But yeah, you just play it by ear, really.
Now, the last time I saw you on TV was in Sky's production of Fortitude, set way up at the edge of the Arctic Circle. What was that like?
Oh, it was a lovely job, yeah, because it was four trips to Iceland I got out of that. And I got killed by, eaten by a polar bear in the first scene of the first episode, but fortunately they extensively used flashbacks, so I appeared in quite a few episodes. And it was a mate of mine, Simon Donald, who was an actor, who'd written it. I think he got me the part, really. Yeah, it was an amazing piece of work.
Let's see, you were a bit of a nasty character in it, and yet the next day you're reading Julia Donaldson books to children.
Yeah, I mean, just you couldn't make it up sometimes, an actor's life, hey diddly-dee. It was because I'd said to them, look, I have to finish on this day, the 13th of June, I think it was, because I had committed to this, following the baton around the country, Commonwealth Games, reading, attempting to read all of Julia Donaldson stories to kids. And there was no way anybody else could do it. I couldn't pull out of it. So I thought, I'll probably lose this job. And that would have been a bummer. But they accommodated that and made sure that all my stuff would get done. And so the exteriors were all in Iceland, but the studio stuff was in London. So I had to finish that day, and I had a really hardcore rape scene to film that night, and they had to extend and get me a later flight back up. But it was really, really was tough stuff. And then the next morning, I was in the Children's Wood up in North Kelvin Meadow, just up here, doing Superworm with Julia Donaldson. Amazing.
And during the baton relay, I managed to speak to Tam on the road.
Could it be, or could it be Stickman? Come back to the family tree. Yes.
Now, are you becoming very familiar with Julia Donaldson's work then?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it beforehand quite a bit because she's been very supportive of a campaign in the west end of Glasgow to save what's called the Children's Wood in North Kelvin Meadow. And that was how initially I got asked to read her books, because she was supporting this campaign to save the land from developers. And then she came down and she heard us reading and that. She was very supportive. And then when the whole Commonwealth Games cultural programme sort of came up, I thought this could be an idea once I knew she had so many books. So yeah, she's been totally supportive, yeah.
Pull a funny face, move your eyes and nose and mouth all over the place.
So we're moving from the Gruffalo to Begbie. Would you recommend The Blade Artist?
Absolutely. It's another amazing piece of work from an extraordinary writer. Yeah, totally, totally. I hope folk will enjoy it. Yeah, but it is pretty hardcore. It is.
T2 Trainspotting is in cinemas now with audio description. And find out what happens next with The Blade Artist by Irvin Welsh, read by Tam Dean Burton. Available commercially now.
Thanks to Robert, Tam and Irvin Welsh for those insights into bringing a text to life. The RNIB Library has a wide selection of Irvin's work available in a variety of formats, so check them out if you want to read on.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away, from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is Read On Air.
Welcome back. Over the years, more than a few authors have sought to distance themselves from the screen adaptations of their books. Truman Capote said that Audrey Hepburn's portrayal of Holly Golightly made him want to throw up. Stephen King loathed what Kubrick did to The Shining. And Roald Dahl didn't have a good word to say about any of the movies of his books, least of all Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. In many cases, the author is right. The book is better than the film it spawns. Even the most skilled filmmaker can't condense a 300-page book into a 90-minute movie without making some major sacrifices. Maybe that's why some of the best adaptations come from short stories or novellas. Today's Educating Red is a case in point. When author Annie Proulx first saw the 2005 film of her 64-page short story Brokeback Mountain, she confessed she was so happy she was knocked into a loop. Despite being filmed in the Canadian Rockies for the most part, rather than Wyoming, where she set it, Proulx has praised the faithfulness of the adaptation, saying, "I may be the first writer in America to have a piece of writing make it to the screen, whole and entire." Ang Lee's movie went on to win 3 Oscars, including that for Best Adapted Screenplay. And certainly when I came to read it recently, years after first watching the film, I immediately recognised the emotional power and poignancy I'd so loved in the film. The story is one of 11 contained in a collection of Proulx's short fiction called Close Range, Wyoming Stories. In case you're not familiar with it, Brokeback Mountain follows Ennis and Jack, 2 young cowboys who meet in the summer of 1963. They're thrown together in the lonely wilderness of the Wyoming mountains and form an intense relationship.
"Too late to go out to them damn sheep," said Ennis, dizzy drunk on all fours, one cold hour when the moon had notched past 2. The meadow stones glowed white-green, and a flinty wind worked over the meadow, scraped the fire low, then ruffled it into yellow silk sashes. "Got you an extra blanket, I'll roll up out here and grab 40 winks, right out at first light. Freeze your ass off when that fire dies down. Better off sleeping in the tent. Doubt I'll feel nothing." But he staggered under canvas, pulled his boots off, snored on the ground cloth for a while, woke Jack with the clacking of his jaw. "Jesus Christ, quit hammering and get over here. Bedroll's big enough," said Jack in an irritable, sleep-clogged voice. It was big enough, warm enough.
The tale of their love for each other and the fear and hatred it arouses in themselves and in others is both brutal and beautiful.
What Jack remembered and craved in a way he could neither help nor understand was the time that distant summer on Brokeback when Ennis had come up behind him and pulled him close, the silent embrace satisfying some shared and sexless hunger. They had stood that way for a long time in front of the fire, its burning, tossing ruddy chunks of light, the shadow of their bodies a single column against the rock. The minutes ticked by from the round watch in Ennis's pocket, from the sticks in the fire settling into coals. Stars bit through the wavy heat layers above the fire. Ennis's breath came slow and quiet. He hummed, rocked a little in the sparklight, and Jack leaned against the steady heartbeat, the vibrations of the humming like faint electricity, and, standing, he fell into sleep that was not sleep, but something else, drowsy and tranced, until Ennis, dredging up a rusty but still usable phrase from the childhood time before his mother died, said, "Time to hit the hay, cowboy. I gotta go. Come on, you're sleeping on your feet like a horse," and gave Jack a shake, a push, and went off into the darkness. Jack heard his spurs tremble as he mounted, the words, "See you tomorrow," and the horse's shuddering snort, grind of hoof on stone. Later, that dozy embrace solidified in his memory as the single moment of artless, charmed happiness in their separate and difficult lives. Nothing marred it. Even the knowledge that Ennis would not then embrace him face to face because he did not want to see nor feel that it was Jack he held. And maybe, he thought. They'd never got much farther than that. Let be. Let be.
Like all the stories in Close Range, the vast and desolate landscape of Wyoming looms over the characters and makes their struggle for survival against elements greater than themselves seem puny and doomed. A perfect backdrop for tragic heroism. Prue refuses to back away from the harshness and violence of small-town American rural life, and her empathy makes that struggle something we can all identify with. Close Range was recommended to me by an American friend in the wake of the US presidential election. You've got to understand the context, he told me. A lot of folks just want hope. It doesn't matter who's giving it or whether it's real. Like Annie Prue writes, people in hell just want a drink of water. That's the title of one of her best short stories, and in many ways sums them all up.
Well, see you around, I guess. The wind tumbled an empty feed bag down the street till it fetched up under his truck. Right, said Jack, and they shook hands, hit each other on the shoulder. Then there was 40 feet of distance between them, and nothing to do but drive away in opposite directions. Within a mile, Ennis felt like someone was pulling his guts out hand over hand, a yard at a time. He stopped at the side of the road and, in the whirling new snow, tried to puke, but nothing came up. He felt about as bad as he ever had, and it took a long time for the feeling to wear off.
Years ago, after enjoying the film, I borrowed a copy of the book, only to abandon it after the first story, The Half-Skinned Steer. And there's no doubt that one will put some readers off. But this time I read on, and I came to see what my friend meant. These are stories from the margins of society. Life is tough and dependent on fickle forces over which people have no control. As one farmer puts it, reality's never been much use out here, but hope is everything. I'm glad I persevered with it. The stories it contains are genuinely moving and made me consider life in a context I am grateful is not my own.
He was a friend of mine. He was a friend of mine.
Annie Prue's Close Range is in the RNIB Library, TV number 15355. And you can also find her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Shipping News, TV number 15748.
Was a friend of mine.
Do you have a book that you feel might give me an education? I'm open to offers. Send me your suggestions via email. The address, once again, is readonair@rnib.org. UK.
This is Read On Air.
I don't know about you, but I love knowing what makes an author tick, what influences they'll admit to, and what gets their creative juices flowing. And so, whenever I get the opportunity, I have to ask them about the books that are meaningful to them. If I could ask you, Stephen Gross, to tell us about the books of your life.
When I was 16, my brother, who was 4 years older, sent me a package of books which did have Freud's interpretation of dreams in it. And I read that, and it blew my mind. It absolutely blew my mind. What it was saying was, we can be unaware of things in ourselves. There are aspects of ourselves that consciously, when we just think about ourselves, we don't see. And we have to infer sometimes our feelings from slips of the tongue and our behaviors or our dreams, and we can start to understand and see ourselves better. That had a huge influence. But when I was very little, I have to say, I loved reading, and I read a great deal. And books, all the E.B. White, Stuart Little, but particularly Charlotte's Web. And I was thinking before coming in, what was it when I was little in those books that, and they're wonderful books to read to children. But Charlotte's Web, I think part of what I loved about it was that from the start, it begins, I think the first sentence is, where's Papa going with that axe? And you remember, there's the runt in the litter, and it's Wilbur. And life, in my consulting room, and living life, and your listeners will know, life is painful. Life is difficult. It has terrible pains in it. it has genuine suffering, and horrible things happen. It can be incredibly cruel and unfair. What was amazing about Charlotte's Web, it doesn't sugarcoat anything. There's loss, there's death at the end. That's how life is. To have that as a child in a children's book, just was a fantastic thing. And I always think, I mean, that's part of what my job as an analyst is, helping people to think about all those difficult things and the pains that are an ordinary part of life. The Rainy Day books I turn to, I do listen to those New Yorker podcasts on fiction. If I'm out walking or just at home sometimes and I have an hour or a half hour, I will listen to the New Yorker fiction podcast with Deborah Treisman speaking to a short story writer about a story that's been published in The New Yorker and their understanding of that story and how it was written. The short story books I turn to are Chekhov, but also an author I really love is Roberto Bolaño. He was he died, unfortunately, at a young age, but he was a great short story writer. He was originally from Chile. He moved to moved to Mexico and eventually to Spain. And I think he died in 2003 at the age of 50. But a book of his I love to pick up and read over and over again is Last Evenings on Earth. It's sort of remarkable, the stories that he tells. There's a kind of ease with them and intimacy that's very special. And the books that I've been reading recently, I loved Graham Swift's Mothering Sunday, which is also beautifully read on audiobooks. It's a fantastic reader, and it's a fantastic story. A very short book, several hours long. It's a bit like Mrs. Dalloway. It all takes place on one day, Mothering Sunday, in the 1920s, and the events of that day, and how it affects the narrator of the story, who tells you the story, but it's looking back many years later in time to that moment. That was a great book. And the other book this past year that I absolutely loved was I Am Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. And again, beautifully read on audiobooks. That's a wonderful, wonderful book. The three books then would be The Kentor Roof, Our Souls at Night, The Mothering Sunday by Graham Swift. And I'm cheating here. I'm giving too many books to your listeners. Finally, I Am Lucy Barton by Elizabeth Strout. Those three books are brief, they're short, and all beautifully read on audiobooks.
Stephen Gross, thank you very much for coming into the studio sharing your love of reading with our listeners. Recently, much-loved children's illustrator and author Babette Cole passed away, but she left a wonderful legacy of work for us to enjoy. Robert Kirkwood takes a look back at some of her best-loved titles.
Babette Cole, the illustrator and author of more than 150 witty, imaginative, irreverent and sometimes controversial picture books for children, has died at the age of 66. She created books on the kinds of disgusting topics that children love and adults mostly do not. And then, emboldened by their success, she went on to more controversial subjects, partly because she liked to shock, and partly because she felt she had a duty to make sure children were properly informed. It was with Beware of the Vet in 1982 that her zany sense of humour and delight in the absurd was first fully unleashed. The account of the mayhem that follows when Mr. McPlaster, the vet, mistakes cow hormones for aspirin and grows horns and a tail. It was a trailblazer for many of Babette's subsequent titles, taking a similar what-if premise. The Trouble with Mum in 1983 stars a mum who is a witch and focuses on the deep and hilarious embarrassment that this causes at the school gates. It's a simple problem, captured brilliantly by Babette in the best tradition of great picture books by contrasting sparing deadpan text with inventive illustrations. Among her bestsellers and available from RNIB Talking Books are the Princess Smartypants books, reimagining the traditional fairy tale heroine as a motorbiking miz.
Princess Smartypants did not want to get married. She enjoyed being a muz. Because she was very pretty and rich, all the princes wanted her to be their missus. Princess Smartypants wanted to live in her castle with her pets and do exactly as she pleased.
"It's high time you smartened yourself up," said her mother, the Queen. "Stop messing about with those animals and find yourself a husband."
Suitors were always turning up at the castle, making a nuisance of themselves.
"Right," declared Princess Smartypants. "Whoever can accomplish the tasks that I set will, as they say, win my hand."
Beth Chalmers reading from Princess Smartypants by Babette Cole. Also available, Dr. Dog, a family pet who dispenses medical advice.
Meet the Gumboil family.
Hello.
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 Oh, hello.
Hello.
And this is their dog.
Hello.
He is a doctor. Dr. Dog went to a conference in Brazil to give a talk about bone marrow. While he was away, Grandad and the Gumboil children got ill.
"We'd better get him back," said Ma Gumboil.
So they sent a telemessage to Brazil.
Telemessage. "We are all ill. Come home, love Gumboils."
And Dr. Dog came home. Kurt Gumboil had been secretly smoking in the bicycle shed. He had a wicked cough.
"It's not good to smoke," said Dr. Dog.
Dr. Dog showed Kurt a picture of people's insides.
"These spongy things inside our chests are called lungs. They are our breathing machines. Smoking fills them up with dirty tar. Then they don't work properly, and so we cough."
Gertie Gumboil had not been wearing her raincoat and hat. She caught a cold and got a sore throat. The germs attacked her tonsils.
"She's got tonsillitis," said Dr. Dog. "I will have to operate."
So he took them out.
That's Lucy Scott reading from Dr. Dog by the late Babette Cole, who passed away in January 2017, aged 66. For more information on these books, head to www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Thank you, Robert, and our condolences to her family, friends and fans. So, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and all those who've contributed to the show. Thanks too to everyone who's been in touch about their reading groups, the books you've been enjoying, and those of you who've given me ideas about books to read up on. Next week, we'll be looking at books inspired by memories of childhood. If you'd like to get in touch about anything to do with books, I'm just an email away. The address to write to is readonair@rnib.org.uk. Until next week, thanks for listening and remember to read on.